Chapter 14. Seeking a pretext for postponement. But once Owen's future is settled, you won't, surely, for the sake of what you call seeing him through, ask that I should go away again without you? He drew her closer as they walked. Len will understand, if you don't. Since he's in the same case himself, I'll throw myself on his mercy. He'll see that I have the first claim on you. He won't even want you not to see it. Owen sees everything. I'm not afraid of that. But his future isn't settled. He's very young to marry too young, his grandmother is sure to think, and the marriage he wants to make is not likely to convince her to the contrary. You don't mean that it's like his first choice? Oh, no. But it's not what Madame de Chantel would call a good match. It's not even what I call a wise one. Yet you're backing him up? Yet I'm backing him up. She paused. Wonder if you'll understand? What I've most wanted for him, and shall want for Effie, is that they shall always feel free to make their own mistakes, and never, if possible, be persuaded to make other people's. Even if Owen's marriage is a mistake, and has to be paid for, I believe he'll learn and grow in the paying. Of course I can't make Madame de Chantel see this, but I can remind her that, with his character, his big rushes of impulse, his odd intervals of ebb and apathy, she may drive him into some worse blunder if she thwarts him now. And you mean to break the news to her as soon as she comes back from Ouchie? As soon as I see my way to it. She knows the girl and likes her. That's our hope. And yet it may, in the end, prove our danger, make it harder for us all when she learns the truth than if Owen had chosen a stranger. I can't tell you more till I've told her. I've promised Owen not to tell anyone. All I ask you is to give me time, to give me a few days at any rate. She's been wonderfully nice, apostrophe as she would call it, about you, and about the fact of my having soon to leave Giver. But that, again, may make it harder for Owen. At any rate, you can see, can't you, how it makes me want to stand by him. You see, I couldn't bear it if the least fraction of my happiness seemed to be stolen from his, as if it were a little scrap of happiness that had to be pieced out with other people's. She clasped her hands on Darrow's arm. Want our life to be like a house with all the windows lit. I'd like to string lanterns from the roof and chimneys. She ended with an inward tremor. All through her exposition and her appeal, as he had told herself, that the moment could hardly have been less well chosen. In Darrow's place she would have felt, as he doubtless did, that her carefully developed argument was only the disguise of an habitual indecision. It was the hour of all others when she would have liked to affirm herself by brushing aside every obstacle to his wishes. Yet it was only by opposing them that she could show the strength of character she wanted him to feel in her. But as she talked, she began to see that Darrow's face gave back no reflection of her words, that he continued to wear the abstracted look of a man who is not listening to what is said to him. It caused her a slight pang to discover that his thoughts could wander at such a moment. Then, with a flush of joy, she perceived the reason. In some undefinable way, as he had become aware, without turning her head, that he was steeped in the sense of her nearness, absorbed in contemplating the details of her face and dress, and the discovery made the words throng to her lips. She felt herself speak with ease, authority, conviction. She said to herself, "He doesn't care what I say, it's enough that I say it, even if it's stupid, he'll like me better for it." She knew that every inflection of her voice, every gesture, every characteristic of her person, its very defects, the fact that her forehead was too high, that her eyes were not large enough, that her hands, though slender, were not small, and that the fingers did not taper, she knew that these deficiencies were so many channels through which her influence streamed to him, that she pleased him in spite of them, perhaps because of them. That he wanted her as she was, and not as she would have liked to be, and for the first time she felt in her veins the security and lightness of happy love. They reached the court and walked under the limes toward the house. The hall door stood wide, and through the windows opening on the terrace the sun slanted across the black and white floor, the faded tapestry chairs, and Darrow's traveling coat and cap, which lay among the cloaks and rugs piled on a bench against the wall. The sight of these garments, lying among her own wraps, gave her a sense of homely intimacy. It was as if her happiness came down from the skies, and took on the plain dress of daily things. At last she seemed to hold it in her hand. As they entered the hall, her eye lit on an unstamped note conspicuously placed on the table. From Owen. He must have rushed off somewhere in the motor. She felt a secret stir of pleasure at the immediate inference that she and Darrow would probably lunch alone. Then she opened the note and stared at it in wonder. "Dear," Owen wrote, "after what you said yesterday I can't wait another hour, and I'm off to Franchule, to catch the Dijon Express and travel back with them. Don't be frightened. I won't speak, unless it's safe to. Trust me for that, but I had to go." She looked up slowly. "He's gone to Dijon to meet his grandmother. Oh, I hope I haven't made a mistake." "You? Why, what have you to do with his going to Dijon?" She hesitated. "He day before yesterday I told him, for the first time, that I meant to see him through, no matter what happened. And I'm afraid he's lost his head, and will be imprudent and spoil things. You see, I hadn't meant to say a word to him till I'd had time to prepare Madame de Chantel." She felt that Darrow was looking at her, and reading her thoughts, and the color flew to her face. "Yes. It was when I heard you were coming, that I told him. I wanted him to feel as I felt. It seemed too unkind to make him wait." Her hand was in his, and his arm rested for a moment on her shoulder. "It would have been too unkind to make him wait." They moved side by side toward the stairs. Through the haze of bliss enveloping her, Owen's affair seemed curiously unimportant and remote. Nothing really mattered, but this torrent of light in her veins. She put her foot on the lowest step, saying, "It's nearly luncheon time, I must take off my hat." And as she started up the stairs, Darrow stood below in the hall and watched her. But the distance between them did not make him seem less near. It was as if his thoughts moved with her, and touched her like endearing hands. In her bedroom she shut the door and stood still, looking about her in a fit of dreamy wonder. Her feelings were unlike any he had ever known. Richer, deeper, more complete. For the first time everything in her, from head to foot, seemed to be feeding the same full current of sensation. She took off her hat, and went to the dressing table to smooth her hair. The pressure of the hat had flattened the dark strands on her forehead. Her face was paler than usual, with shadows about the eyes. She felt a pang of regret for the wasted years. "If I look like this today," she said to herself, "what will he think of me when I'm ill or worried?" She began to run her fingers through her hair, rejoicing in its thickness. Then she desisted and sat still, resting her chin on her hands. "I want him to see me as I am," she thought. Deeper than the deepest fiber of her vanity was the triumphant sense that as she was, with her flattened hair, her tired pallor, her thin sleeves a little tumbled by the weight of her jacket, he would like her even better, feel her nearer, dearer, more desirable, than in all the splendors she might put on for him. In the light of this discovery she studied her face with a new intentness, seeing its defects as he had never seen them, yet seeing them through a kind of radiance, as though love were a luminous medium into which he had been bodily plunged. She was glad now that he had confessed her doubts and her jealousy. She divined that a man in love may be flattered by such involuntary betrayals, that there are moments when respect for his liberty appeals to him less than the inability to respect it. Moments so propitious that a woman's very mistakes and indiscretions may help to establish her dominion. The sense of power he had been aware of in talking to Darrow came back with tenfold force. She felt like testing him by the most fantastic exactions, and at the same moment she longed to humble herself before him, to make herself the shadow and echo of his mood. She wanted to linger with him in a world of fancy, and yet to walk at his side in the world of fact. She wanted him to feel her power, and yet to love her for her ignorance and humility. She felt like a slave, and a goddess, and a girl in her teens. Zia, Darrow, late that evening, threw himself into an armchair before his fire and mused. The room was propitious to meditation. The red-veiled lamp, the corners of shadow, the splashes of firelight on the curves of old full-bodied wardrobes and cabinets, gave it an air of intimacy increased by its faded hangings, its slightly frayed and threadbare rugs. Everything in it was harmoniously shabby, with a subtle sought for shabbiness in which Darrow fancied he discerned the touch of Fraser Leaf. But Fraser Leaf had grown so unimportant a factor in the scheme of things, that these marks of his presence caused the young man no emotion beyond that of a faint retrospective amusement. The afternoon and evening had been perfect. After a moment of concern over her stepson's departure, Anna had surrendered herself to her happiness with an impetuosity that Darrow had never suspected in her. Early in the afternoon they had gone out in the motor, traversing miles of sober-tinted landscape in which, here and there, a scarlet vineyard flamed, clattering through the streets of stony villages, coming out on low slopes above the river, or winding through the pale gold of narrow wood roads with the blue of clear-cut hills at their end. Over everything lay a faint sunshine that seemed dissolved in the still air, and the smell of wet roots and decaying leaves was merged in the pungent scent of burning underbrush. Once, at the turn of a wall, they stopped the motor before a ruined gateway, and, stumbling along a road full of ruts, stood before a little old deserted house, fantastically carved and chimneyed, which lay in a moat under the shade of ancient trees. They paced the paths between the trees, found a moldy temple of love on an islet among reeds and plantains, and, sitting on a bench in the stable yard, watched the pigeons circling against the sunset over their cot of patterned brick. Then the motor flew on into the dusk. When they came in they sat beside the fire in the oak drawing room, and Darrow noticed how delicately her head stood out against the somber paneling, and mused on the enjoyment there would always be in the mere fact of watching her hands as they moved about among the tea things. They dined late, and facing her across the table, with its low lights and flowers, he felt an extraordinary pleasure in seeing her again in evening dress, and in letting his eyes dwell on the proud shy set of her head, the way her dark hair clasped it, and the girlish thinness of her neck above the slight swell of the breast. His imagination was struck by the quality of reticence in her beauty. She suggested a fine portrait kept down to a few tones, or a Greek vase on which the play of light is the only pattern. After dinner they went out on the terrace for a look at the moon-misted park. Through the crepuscular whiteness the trees hung in blotted masses. Below the terrace, the garden drew its dark diagrams between statues that stood like muffled conspirators on the edge of the shadow. Farther off, the meadows unrolled a silver-shot tissue to the mantling of mist above the river, and the autumn stars trembled overhead like their own reflection seen in dim water. He lit a cigar, and they walked slowly up and down the flags, in the languid air, till he put an arm about her, saying, "Colin, you mustn't stay till you're chilled." Then they went back into the room, and drew up their chairs to the fire. It seemed only a moment later that she said, "Colin, it must be after 11, and stood up and looked down on him, smiling faintly. He sat still, absorbing the look, and thinking. There'll be evenings and evenings till she came nearer, bent over him, and with a hand on his shoulder said, "Colin, good night." He got to his feet and put his arms about her. "Good night," he answered, and held her fast. And they gave each other a long kiss of promise and communion. The memory of it glowed in him still as he sat over his crumbling fire, but beneath his physical exultation he felt a certain gravity of mood. His happiness was in some sort the rallying point of many scattered purposes. He summed it up vaguely by saying to himself that to be loved by a woman like that made all the difference. Daddy was a little tired of experimenting on life. He wanted to make a line, to follow things up, to centralize and concentrate, and produce results. 2 or 3 more years of diplomacy with her beside him, and then their real life would begin. Study, travel, and bookmaking for him, and for her, well, the joy, at any rate, of getting out of an atmosphere of bric-a-brac, and card leaving into the open air of competing activities. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.